press that was being used to operate Bundy's saucer apparatus. Now, since I didn't have the calling to design apparatus, I approached Bundy with my idea. He was semi-enthused. At least he was willing to help me get it constructed. I did not have a shop order on which apparatus could be constructed, and you had to have a shop order to get work done in the GE machine shop. So this device, which I have described originally in this GE report number RL-1064, of which I have a copy, and which I've already mentioned, was later published in the Review of Scientific Instruments in 1960. Well, this device was built, worked quite well, I thought, although Bundy disagreed. He lost his enthusiasm completely about this device after we tried it out. And in his confidential reports to the boss, Neerad, he told him that it didn't hold any promise. Now, this device did have quite a bit larger volume than Bundy's saucer, and according to my test, could reach a higher pressure and a higher temperature. Before I had actually constructed this particular device, in fact, I believe in February of 1953, I decided that this device could be double-ended, making the belt. This thing was called a belt. It's kind of a code name, just a toroidal ring around the inner chamber. Gave it the name the belt. The half belt was just half of this device. It had a piston coming in, a tapered piston coming in from one end instead of two ends. Both of these devices were entirely different from Francis Bundy's device. Because Bundy didn't think the half belt was any good, however, I could not receive permission to construct the full belt. Well, I stewed about this a little bit for a while, and finally decided that somehow I was going to have to take matters into my own hands and get this device built. Because from the analysis that I had performed and the new ideas that I had in this device, I could see that I could get a two-stage effect in a one-stage device. All of these things are described in the various publications that I have made down through the years. Of course, there was a period of 7 years of secrecy on these particular ideas of mine, which was very discouraging. Here was 7 years going by that I had had these ideas and had got them working. And I knew that there were leaks within the company of these ideas to the outside, and that eventually someone else was going to publish things along these lines, and I was going to be beat out on a development, an apparatus development, that was the culmination of 125 years of scientific effort in attempts to build apparatus that were suitable for synthesizing diamond. Fortunately, my fears were only partially realized. I even though the company waited until 1960 before letting me publish this, no one succeeded in beating me to publication on these particular ideas, although some people came pretty close, and I think the reason they did come close was because of being able to see pictures of the Bell apparatus, which were given with a press release in 1955, although not in minute detail, also because of other leaks that there were within the company. Well, to get back to the Bell apparatus, since the company wouldn't let me build it, I went to the machine shop and talked to the fellows down there that I knew real well by this time, and just asked if they wouldn't build it. I didn't give them the shop order number. I just asked if they wouldn't build it when they had slack time and weren't working on the things that Bundy and Strong wanted built. Well, this they did. Now, it took a long time. It took about 6 months, as I remember it, for them to complete my first belt apparatus made out of steel. Ryder Owens, who was sitting here, asked me when they completed it. I don't know whether I have any record of that or not. I probably do in my GE notebook. But, of course, the GE company has those in their possession. I have some 35mm copies of the notebook, but they've deteriorated through the years, and I don't know whether they're any good at this point or not.
They
are
pretty good.
At any rate, as I remembered, it was about 6 months, which would have placed this sometime around June or July of 1963 that I received the Bell apparatus from the shop. Well, during the time in which the belt apparatus was being constructed, I obtained additional ideas as to how to increase its effectiveness. One of these ideas was to use a sandwich gasket. This is also described in my various publications. Now, I had broken the components to the half belt at this point. And so, in order to try my sandwich gasket idea, I first tried it out in Bundy's saucer. Now, this increased the effectiveness of the saucer considerably and proved the point that this would work in any kind of device using compressible gaskets. When I first told my associates about this sandwich gasket idea, they poo-pooed it. As a matter of fact, Herb Strong says it's no damn good, just like that. I paid no attention to them, though, and tried it out in Bundy's saucer apparatus, where it proved itself. So when I finally got my belt from the shop, I immediately incorporated the sandwich gasket idea into what later came to be called the flower pot gasket. Now, I was convinced right off that the belt apparatus was a good device. I immediately set about to try and find out the pressures that it would achieve by getting various transitions in the device that Bridgman had discovered in his flat anvils. Now, Bridgman's flat anvils worked on an extremely minute sample, could not be heated, but could obtain in a paper-thin sample about 3/8 of an inch in diameter pressures of 100,000 atmospheres. And in this minute apparatus, Bridgman had measured the electrical resistance of almost all the metals and had found sharp changes in electrical resistance in these things occurring at given pressures. And I was using these to try and find out how high a pressure my apparatus would go to. Well, I ran the bismuth transition and the thallium transition, and and so on. Now, I was quite convinced that in my steel apparatus, I could get pressures somewhere around the order of 50,000 atmospheres, possibly higher. And of course, the volume was much larger than the volume in the saucer. And with the principles that I had at work here, I felt if I could only build the tapered pistons and the chamber out of piston carbide, I could get to the goal of 100,000 atmospheres in an apparatus that would be much simpler, much, much simpler than Bridgman's two-stage apparatus that Strong and Mundy were still thinking about but had not yet designed in a scaled-up version for the new press that was under construction. Well, although my colleagues and the boss were not willing to admit that the apparatus that I had at this point was any good, you see, they were definitely committed to this $150,000 press and this two-stage device of Bridgman's, seeing me work kind of started giving them ideas too. And here at one point, Herb Strong decided, Strong became interested in seeing if he couldn't use a piston and cylinder in a two-stage device, but in a somewhat simpler way than Bridgman had used it. Later on, he started to put a collar around the top of his piston that was composed of a sandwich gasket. It was a stack of pyrophilite rings alternating with steel rings. Well, this was exactly the sandwich gasket system that he had told me earlier was no damn good. But he never did refer to this as a sandwich gasket. He always called it a collar. And whenever any of us jumped him about this, and there were others besides myself, it always seemed to make him mad. No, it wasn't at all like Hall's sandwich gasket. This was a collar. Well, I'm getting a little bit ahead of the story here, but later on, Strong decided that this wouldn't work quite right either, so instead of having a straight circular cylinder, he made his cylinder tapered, just like the tapered piston that I had originally used in the half belt. Now, when he had a tapered piston, then he had to make his gasket flower pot shaped, just like mine, and again, it had alternating layers of steel and pyrophilite. It was a sandwich gasket, but still, Strong kept calling it a collar. Well, he had now arrived at the point of development of my half belt, yet I had long since had the full belt working. Well, as he moved along, he experienced the same troubles with his half belt that I experienced with my half belt. He had cracking at the bottom of the chamber. And the only way to eliminate this cracking is to make a full belt out of it. Well, Strong didn't want to go quite all that way. He just always tried to seem to be following what I was doing, yet try and keep it different enough that he wouldn't exactly be duplicating what I was doing. So he finally made a belt, a full-section belt chamber, but plugged up one end of it so that he only worked on it from one side, like my half belt, so that he wouldn't have the trouble of the splitting at the bottom of the cylinder. Well, later on, to my amazement, Strong was able to get patents, independent of my own patents, on various versions of this half belt, which was obviously just a takeoff on the principles that I had developed many, many months before. Well, to get back to my story, I wanted to have the chamber and the pistons of the belt made out of tungsten carbide. Now, this would have cost about $1,000, or somewhere in that neighborhood, for the chamber and a couple of sets of pistons. Well, I wasn't getting anywhere. I couldn't convince my co-leagues, at least they acted unconvinced, that I had anything. I always felt that they were trying to protect their own skins. They had committed to this vast sum of money to this double-acting press, and they weren't going to admit that a guy might have figured out a way to not have to use that big double-acting press. So I talked to my former boss, Liebhofsky, who was running a seminar among the chemists in the physical chemistry group, and asked him if I could give a talk on some of my high pressure developments. Now, theoretically, I shouldn't have done this. This project was very secret. Other people working in other sections, other groups, divisions within the research laboratory were not supposed to know about this. Well, I talked to Liebhofsky and his group. They all enjoyed my talk immensely. And Liebhofsky was very impressed, thought that I had a first-class development here. And so he talked to Murat and others, including Suits, and convinced them that I had something here that ought to be allowed to pursue. Well, subsequently, I did procure these components in tungsten carbide. Tungsten carbide having a higher compressive strength than steel and being only one-third as compressible will always allow you to obtain a higher pressure no matter what the apparatus is if you construct the vital components from this material. Well, I immediately was able to show that I could get now to truly high pressures. I obtained the cesium transition, no doubt being the first man to obtain this transition after Bridgman had succeeded in discovering it. I obtained the barium transition, which at that time was thought to occur at 77,400 atmospheres. We now know that it comes at 59,000 atmospheres, but this earlier pressure was the pressure that Bridgman had put on it as he had discovered it in his flat anvil apparatus. And so on. Extrapolating upward, I had been to pressures easily of 100,000 atmospheres. Now, I was very cautious at this time in life. I'd been raised as a poor boy, had never had any money, and was always extremely conscientious with regard to the cost of things. I'd see others going pell-mell forward, spending company money all over the place. But I was always very cautious, and this sort of thing did, besides the fact that I was always quite reticent and not forward, kind of experiments that I would do. But I did subject graphite in this apparatus to a pressure at one point. Let's see, I probably have the date here. The date of my report is February 27, 1954. Memo report C-54-51, Chemistry Research Department. Title report was an attempt to synthesize diamond at 78,000 atmospheres and 2,400 degrees centigrade. Well, it was kind of discouraging, of course, to bid to reach these high pressures. I could have gone above 100,000 atmospheres if I'd wanted to risk my tungsten carbide, but I was afraid they wouldn't buy me anymore. But anyway, at the 78,000 atmospheres, we now know wasn't this high, but even so, it was, let's see, it would have been somewhere around 60,000 atmospheres at any rate. And I could have gone much higher, as I said, if I'd been, had plenty of tungsten carbide to break. Well, at this point, of course, the thing to do was to go back to chemical systems and see what one might do in the way of finding a catalyst, or starting with a material other than graphite, to make the diamonds. Now, I tried hundreds of chemical systems as time went on, all sorts of reactions trying to make diamonds. It might be interesting to mention at this time that I had learned on a visit to the University of Utah that Loring Coase at the Norton Company had synthesized a new silica mineral, which later came to be known as coaseite, at a pressure around 30,000 atmospheres at 700 degrees centigrade or so. I'm returning back to, I probably mixed up on the date of this. I think I learned this in 1953. Now that I look back, it's when we came out west to the ACS meetings in California on a vacation to Utah in 1953, and talking with Irene Kistler at the University of Utah, I learned about this coaseite. I immediately went back to the GE lab and put some sodium silicate solution in Bundy's saucer apparatus. It must have been at this point that my half belt was broken and my full belt was not yet constructed, but I made some beautiful crystals of coaseite, and no doubt was the second man after Coase first discovered them to make these particular crystals. And in searching for things to put in my device to give me some ideas of pressures that I was achieving, I was always eagerly looking for these. I had been given the data that coaseite required something like 32,000 atmospheres and 700 degrees centigrade, and I use this also as a calibration point on my apparatus. I'd be wrong to point out that I was by far the most active person on this diamond project from the time that it was decided that the $150,000 press with the two-stage apparatus was going to be built. The project pretty much fell apart, and it was only because of these ideas that I was pursuing on apparatus that wouldn't require this press that things were kept somewhat active. Bundy was off working on turbine bearings, and Strong was working on P0, so was Bundy working on this at times. And I've already mentioned some of the things that the others of us were doing, but I was the one that was carrying the ball on the diamond project. Now, Wintour was interested in using my device, the belt, and did use it extensively for some period of time, trying out chemical systems, trying to synthesize diamonds. Bundy and Strong never did express any interest in the device, other than the fact that Strong seemed to follow along closely behind me in building devices with that were similar, yet that he wanted to declare that he had invented independently and were not as similar as they actually were. Well, now, sometime along in what I would guess was late summer of 1954, this gigantic 1,000-ton double-acting press was delivered. It was a monstrous thing.
Had to be a special pit built for it in the floor, and then it continued on up for a couple of stories above that floor.
Now, it's interesting that Strong and Bundy never did get around to designing that scaled-up version of Bridgman's two-stage piston apparatus. But along in the fall, Strong had built a half belt with my flower pot conical sandwich gasket arrangement. And he was beginning to experiment with this in this huge press that had been delivered. Now, of course, this did not require the double acting principle and could just as well have been used in the old Watson Stillman press that I've been using all the time. This device, this half belt that Strong was using, was constructed of steel. And he was experimenting with various systems trying to make diamonds. Now, along in the first part of December, first or second week of December, Strong had put a mixture in of materials known as carburizing compounds. It was some particular brand name of a carburizing compound that did contain carbon, but what else was in it no one would have ever known without a chemical analysis. It was just a trademarked carburizing material used for hardening steel. He had put this in a chamber of this half belt apparatus at a temperature that he thought was of the order of 1200 degrees centigrade, and had let it stay there overnight in a 16-hour run. So as I remember it, it was a 13 or 16-hour run. Now, he had put some seed diamonds in this particular device. Now, he had opened his chamber and taken the contents out of this thing, and then had put them on his desk in an open little petri dish that we used to use for holding things, and had let this thing sit there for a week or two open on his desk. Now, along sometime, he must have made the run about the first part of December, but along a week or two later, he decided to analyze this to see if he'd made any diamonds. Well, he took the thing to a lab to have it polished so he could examine it under a microscope. And the polishing wheel had apparently struck something hard, and on fooling around, they found a couple of diamonds in this device, over and above, Strong says, the diamonds that he had put in it. Now, he was going to have these diamonds x-rayed, and Strong's story is that they lost one of the diamonds, but he still had one of them left. Now, this diamond looked, in physical size and general appearance and characteristics, exactly like some diamond chips that we had obtained on a trip that I had made to New York City for use in our experiments. Well, here was a diamond that Strong thought he had synthesized, because he claims that he didn't put any of that kind of diamond in as a seed. He claimed he had put little tiny octahedra in as seeds. Now, you might wonder about the reason for putting seeds in. Well, whenever you grow any crystals, they need to somehow be nucleated. That is, they've got to start to grow somewhere. And very often, they a new diamond might start to grow on old diamonds. So that's the reason for putting in diamond seeds. Well, I was very skeptical of this whole business, particularly because the fragments that he had there looked identical to these diamond chips. By the way, I have written a memo on my interesting trip to New York City to